Okay, Dr. Mark, let's go. Let's see which letters of the Rav we can finish up today.
Okay, and let me just say about Rabbi Mandelbaum, we spoke, it's amazing to think it's already been a year, because we spoke about him last year also on his York site, and he played an important part in the Lieberman classes, and I think I even, I don't know if I showed the Matseva last time, and mentions his great work on the Psitter of Kahana. But so thank you to the Mandelbaum family. And as Rabbi Kelman, they sent out the letter, the email, that it's the last in the series. It's not the last we're going to be doing Letters of the Rav, but it's the last we're going to be doing before we take the break. And I see Rabbi Yellen, and I hope Rabbi Shudnow is with us. If not, he'll come in soon, because we're going to be dealing with chaplaincy. We might have some other chaplains on it, so that'll be of interest. And as Rabbi Kelman said, there still is time if you want to travel with us. The trip to Tunisia is going to be amazing. It's not the sort of thing you go by yourself, but we'll see things that, obviously, if you're a Star Wars fan, you know, I can sell you on that. We're going to see Star Wars, but we're going to see really about Jewish history and other things. It's really something. And then Greece. The Greece, you know, Athens and Jerusalem, we've always been at odds, but we've gained, and we've had a symbiosis with Greece. And like on all our trips, we see all the important general sites and the Jewish sites. So we have good crowds, but we could always use a few more. Okay, before we begin, I just want to, in no order, in particular, I have a huge pile of books. I don't know if you could see it here, but I want to settle a few things before we end. And one, this is going to upset some people, fans of Rabbi Eric Kefet, but what can I say? If you recalled last time, I left it hanging. That on the one hand, you have Rakefet, who's told the story numerous times, so the people who've listened to him know the story, that and it's a heroic story. Rabbi Kahana, there's no machitza, he gets his young people to put the machitza, and it leads him to being fired. And then I showed you, however, Libby Kahana's book, who says just the opposite, that they agreed to put the machitza in. Why they agreed and to leave the United Synagogue, because maybe she says he wanted so little as a salary. And the story is that he began to influence the young people. They wanted to keep kosher and Shabbos and all that. And they thought that he was undermining family relations, so he was fired. But the question is, was there a machitza or not when he took the shul? I raised it. I said, if anyone was from Howard Beach, if anyone knows anything, so thank you, Moshe, who's on top of this, not that he grew up there or knows it personally, but he forwarded me the following thing. Here you have an article from the Jewish Post and Opinion from the time. In fact, you see, Rabbi quits. Children are too observant, Congregation's board says. And it quotes this Victor Kirschenbaum pointing out that the rabbi was indoctrinating the student in Torah. Can you imagine? It's like the old joke. You bring the rabbi in to give a sermon, and you ask the president says, prospective rabbi, what do you want to speak about? He says, Shabbos. No, you can't speak about Shabbos. Kashrus, you know, all the things he says, no, you can't speak about. So finally, exasperated, the rabbi says, well, what am I supposed to speak about? He says, speak about being a good Jew. So this Kirschenbaum, incidentally, if you read Libby Kahana's book, you see on page 48, she speaks about him, how he was unobservant, but his dedication to this Howard Beach Jewish Center reflected an affinity of Judaism, not lost on his sons, and they became observant. So it was the Kirschenbaum's children became observant and live in Israel now. So that's interesting. But here's the article. And in the article, it says as follows. Hold on a second. Let me move this here so I can see it better. It says, all we agreed, said Kirschenbaum, was that he could have a machitza between the men and the women. And then the rest of the things Kahana did, you know, influencing them to his old-fashioned Torah ideas that they didn't want. But here you have black and white from the time that they agreed that put a machitza up to, mollify or satisfy Rabbi Meir Kahana. So here you have it. So Libby Kahana's version is absolutely correct. Those of you who know Rabbi Kefet, you can ask him about this. He lived in America at the time. But he's repeating something that wasn't true, that wasn't correct. You have it here, black and white, that that the people, the president of the shul, pointing out here that yes, we compromised on the machitza. However, we weren't going to compromise on other things, and that's why they got rid of Mayor Kahan. So there you have it. Thank you very much, Moshe. The next thing I want to call your attention to is, let me share my screen to something else. I mentioned about not having an image. I said that there's a shul I know that has images of the stars and the moon and everything on the front next to the Aron Kodesh. It's very artistic. And I said that, how could you do that? And so here's explicitly in the Rambam. It's in Avodah Zarah, chapter 1, Halacha Yud Aleph. It's not just talking about in the shul, it's talking about anywhere. You can't make these images. And this is found in the Shulchan Aruch also, in Kuf Mem Aleph. It says, and then it goes on, and it says, certain things you can't do. It only refers to if it comes out, but not if it's flat. But then it says, the tsuras chamol avon v'chochavim asur. Doesn't matter whether it's, what's that word? Protruding. That's the word. Or flat. So there you have it. You can't do it anytime. All the more so, in a shul. Hold on a second. I want to show you something. Even though that's what I thought should be the halacha. However, look what you find here. It says right at the end, after it says, V'tzuras chamo avon v'chovim asur, whether it's protruding or whether it's not, it says, the Ramah says, V'yesh matirin b'shal rabim, d'leka chashta. The Ramah says there are those who are matirit, because there's no fear. And so what does that mean? There's no fear in the Rabbim that you're gonna worship it as idolatry or anything. Look at the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch. So I take back what I said, that at least it does appear that there's some sort of heter from the Ramah. So that's okay. A number of people asked me about ball playing on Shabbos. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I'm not an expert in Hilchos Shabbos. Let me just say that I'm looking right now in Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa, chapter 16, Halacha Vav. Ein esor mischakei kador, mehotzi mischak kadorego, afilu mechutz habayit bimkom shel yesheruv, avehu adin lagabai mischak tennis hashulchan, ping pong. The Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa says you can't aser ball playing, with the exception of soccer, and in regular ball playing, even outside if there's an Eruv. So what's the issue? Now, if you look in the, I think I have it here. Hold on a second. I think I pulled up the, yes. Okay, so this is basically, first of all, you have the Shulchan Aruch. In Aruch Chaim 308, Asar Lischok B'Shabbos V'Yom Tov V'Kadur. That's the Shulchan Aruch. But the Ramah says V'Yesh Matirin V'Na'u L'Hakil. So that's the, for Sfardim, it's more problematic playing ball. Ashkenazi, not. But what's the problem? Well, the problem is that if you look in the Mishnah Brura, he says that the problem is playing on karka, let's say dirt, because of chashash, you might ashvuye gumos, you might flatten the surface. So we spoke about this last time. Now you're going to say, well, what's the problem? You don't intend it, but you benefit and you want it. You can't play a game on dirt if there's bumps. So by you running, if you flatten it, that's considered something, it's not a psik resha d'onichale, you want it, and therefore it's forbidden. Yeah. That wouldn't apply on concrete. But I saw that in Beis Arav Yisrael, the great Revichiel Goldhaber actually has, in number 39, he has an article on this, and he quotes, this is a personal comment that he got from Rishon Zalman Arbach, that this doesn't apply when the Mokom HaMishrach, you prepare it ahead of time. So he says that technically, if it would be, Rav Shlomo Zalman says that if it would be something where you play generally on, it's not just like a field, then there's other Isurim, you can say. But it wouldn't be that, you don't have to worry about that. And then he quotes Rav Yoshev again. He's not quoting from a sefer, so I guess he quotes it personally, that it's, what does he say here? Oh, he says that we're talking about a mishak that you, like you roll it. It's not referring to basketball or anything else. So that's why, as we saw, Rav Kook was so adamant that you have to distinguish different types of ball playing. You have to distinguish when it's a, hold on a second. Let me, you have to distinguish ball playing when it's like an organized event and there's Chilul Shabbos versus private ball playing in the backyard, which is not a good thing. It's not the best thing. People should be focusing on other matters. But he didn't want to say it was usher because he couldn't say it's usher when we saw the Shulchan Aruch says explicitly. Two more things. I misspoke about the Cedar Sinai. I said that Rav Asher Weiss has the letter. I went back to what Rabbi Yellen sent me, and then I spoke to Rabbi, emailed with Rabbi Wiener. It's actually Eretz Chemda has the letter permitting the Interfaith Chapel, but Rav Asher Weiss signed on to this and says, you can quote me that it's 100% permissible to, and in Rabbi Wiener's article, he quotes the Rav, he quotes Rav Schechter, he quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein, who opposed it. So, just want to correct everything. Ah, one of you emailed me about Rabbi Teitz and Soviet Jewry. And I just want to clarify something. Rabbi Teitz opposed individuals protesting. However, he believed in quiet diplomacy, and he also believed in Jacques Vanek, which was very, it was a law that tied the most favored nation trade status to, treating, immigration for Jews and just basically treating them properly in terms of their rights to worship, etc. So it's not that he just believed in quiet diplomacy. He thought that, in fact, he said in my conversation with him, he said that Senator Jackson was one of Tzaddiki Umos Ha'olam. So that he thought was valuable, Jackson Vanek. He didn't think it's valuable for us all to go on the street and start protesting. And as I said, the Rav had a different opinion. Glenn Richter from Student Struggle with Soviet Jewry went to the Rav. And the Rav said to go ask the Sovietologist at Columbia Glenn was told that that he thinks it's important to go protest. That's why you students felt comfortable in being involved with this. Okay, my final point I want to make, and that takes us back to one more thing. I want to remind you of something we saw. This last class I mentioned in the Rav's shiurim, Rav Schechter quotes him as saying that on a stove you should have on Shabbos, also cover the knobs, and also about the covering the buttons on the oven. And I say, I never heard of covering buttons on an oven. No. But the stove, that's a more popular shita. And then I remembered after we're done that in this letter, remember, we only had the first page, but look at the last two lines. I would advise you to put a tin or tinfoil cover on the, we don't have what comes after that, but there's no question that what he's referring to is, put on the knobs. And how do I know that? I know that because I'm looking right now at, which I've showed you also before, the Maimonides Rules for Caterers. And what does the Rav say? The flame must be covered with a metal covering before sunset, and the knobs must also be covered or removed. So whereas in the letter to Rabbi Hout, he doesn't say you're obligated. He says it's a better thing to do. And I think that's the standard approach, that it's a better thing to do, but it's not, according to most poskim, I think Moshe's machmir, but according to most poskim, they don't think it's actually obligatory. But in the letter, and to Rabbi Hout, that's why he advises him it's a better thing to do. But in the rules for caterers, which we saw already are more strict than the Rav's own position, he just says that it must be covered or removed. Again, I think it's, you can explain this, that you have to be more careful with caterers because they're not, you can't always rely, money issues. If there's a problem, they might violate it. Incidentally, in terms of not Shabbos, but on Yom Tov, I saw something a few years ago at the hotel that was after Pesach, and then I saw that this is at all the hotels, it seems, and I was surprised because I didn't know this, and apparently this is accepted halacha. I'm not the expert in halacha, so I don't know all these things. That on Yom Tov, of course, they have omelets and everything. There, we know you're allowed to cook, but if you go, let's say Yom Tov is Sunday night and Monday morning. Sunday night, these electric, let's say, omelet makers are not plugged in. They're not even there. They plug them in Monday morning. So that was a little surprising to me. I didn't know that that was permissible. You're plugging it in on Yom Tov to. So I spoke to the Mashgiach, who works for the Vod of, this was Broward County, this is years ago. And then I've seen it at the other places. And they say, no, but that's it's Tzarchei Rabim, it's all that. And they, I don't know if you'd be allowed to do this in your private house, but that's what they do. I don't know if all of them do that, but I've been to two or three hotels under different hashgachas, and they do it. Now we continue with the Rav. We're hopeful to get to two letters here in Rabbi Helfgott's book, and fascinating letters. The second letter I want to look at, it's actually letter number two, and it deals with an issue that isn't so, it's not so popular today, the issue of foundlings. What do you do with a baby that does it, just shows up, or what are you going to do with her? We don't have that many babies being dropped off in front of police stations or babies given up. I guess that's abortion. That you know, with abortion, it's not such an issue anymore. In the book Freakonomics, I think the first volume, or maybe it's the second, the argument is made, Giuliani made a big deal about the fact that through broken windows, which is those in the New York area know I'm talking about, if you're makpid, if you're you see broken windows and graffiti, if you enforce all these things, it creates a an atmosphere that all crime is reduced. And we all know that during the Giuliani administration, and that continued even after him, crime was very low in New York. And their argument was that it's not the broken windows, it's not the crime fighting, it's abortion. And they said, you look at when abortion becomes legal, and then you look, and he says crime was, the argument is crime was falling all over the country, and they can correlate it, they say, although it doesn't really work with New York because abortion was always legal. But they claim, their argument was that kids growing up without a stable home are more likely to turn to crime. So when you have abortion, they made clear to say that they're not advocating abortion, but they're saying when you have abortion, you're going to have less crime because you're going to have less kids growing up in these sort of broken homes. Well, to this, I would only say that I think the last 10 years has proven them wrong, because abortion has now been legal for a long time, leaving aside what happened recently. And anyone who's lived in any of our big cities, progressive cities, I think you'll agree that it has nothing to do with abortion, yes or no. It has to do with progressive-run cities leads to crime. And I don't see any way. I think if anything is obvious, what we've seen the last 10 years, that is obvious. Okay, but you have these foundlings, you have children, and who do they belong to? I assume we're only speaking about, let's say, especially in those days, in the 50s, white babies. So you might say, well, why is this an issue? Well, maybe they're Jewish, and maybe the Jewish community should, these have, we don't know who these babies are, it's anonymous. So who are they going to be distributed to? You're going to give it to the Catholics, the Protestants? What about the Jews? It's like something that if you ask the person off the street, their typical religious person, their attitude would be, what are you talking about? You crazy? Not to mention the fact that most people are not Jewish. And why do we assume that they're Jewish? The Rav felt differently. He has an article here to the American Jewish Congress, Dr. David Pedagorsky. I didn't know anything about him. I looked him up. He was a YU person, as even something was named after him. He has two sons who are well known in their fields. And the Rav's argument in this letter is that although until 1950, all these children were turned over to Catholic and Protestant adoption agencies, the Rav's argued in this letter that the Jews should also make a claim that these could be Jewish children. And it's not just that. I mean, it's the claim is that they're Jewish. They could be Jewish. Now, as the Rav explains, this isn't enough to consider them halachically Jewish in the sense that they don't need a conversion. But the Rav explains why. We don't need to go into the halachic give and take here, but he says, for instance, he wants to know whether majority is applicable in our case. And because if the majority are not Jewish, you might say, well, then we assume they're not Jewish. But he thinks otherwise. He thinks that nevertheless, halacha will still assume that each one of these children can be Jewish. And he says, we must see to it that our ratio of abandoned children includes all children found in Jewish districts. Fascinating that he says that. Then he says, however, you can't assume they're Jewish. They have a possibility, so we have to claim them, and then we can convert them. And then he says that, and this is absolutely okay. You're allowed to convert, and we know that you're allowed to convert. But in this case, you might say, well, maybe, you know, they were already baptized. We don't know anything about that. And even if they were, we are allowed to convert. He talks about... he says, although it perhaps offends our sense of liberalism and progressiveness, it nevertheless prevails as halachic law, namely that you can convert a child. He says, when a Jewish family adopts a child and gives him devotion and love, the foster parents are entitled to convert their child and rear him in their faith. Should we, however, give up our rights, he says? Because of complications, public relations, you know, the Catholics and the Protestants are going to be annoyed. You know, why are the Jews getting involved with this? Why do they think any of these babies are Jewish? And he says, definitely no. He says, listen to this. The Jewish religion has never monopolized the media of salvation, nor has it identified itself with the intolerant doctrine of religious Catholicity. In other words, it never maintained that our faith is destined to become universal in order to save mankind from damnation. He says that we're not saying that everyone has to become Jewish. And that unless you're Jewish, you know, you're not going to be saved, to use the Christian term. However, he says, that doesn't mean that we do not stand up for our own self. He says, this tolerant philosophy of transcendental universalism does not exclude the specific awareness of the Jews of the supremacy of their faith over all others. This is something that many rabbis today in the non-Orthodox, I think the Orthodox wouldn't have an issue, but the Rav unapologetically says, although we recognize that, you know, other people relate to God in different ways, and we're not saying that everyone has to become Jewish, nevertheless, we assert the supremacy of our faith over all others. And that leads you to the question of ecumenical relations, how to view other religions, interfaith. And there's a few different approaches to this. We have the Gandhi approach, which is very popular today, which basically is that Gandhi believed that all religions are true, true with a small t, that every religion is true. What makes a religion true? If it leads a person to makes them a better person. And if it makes you a worse person, if it causes you to commit terrible acts, the religion is false. But we can't speak, Gandhi would say, about theological truths, because every religion independently has its own theology. And we can only speak, you know, Gandhi's approach is my religion works for me, your religion works for you, and it's not for me to opine as to your theology. In other words, religious relativism. All true religions are equally valid. They all take you to the same place. It's a very popular conception today. It might even be the majority conception in America that the religion is sort of like flavors of ice cream. Some people like vanilla, some like chocolate. They're all different branches of a tree. Different roads take you to the same place. But that's not why Jews gave up their lives in medieval times when faced with other religions. And those of us coming with us to Portugal, you're going to learn all about this. It was a tragic, tragic story. Maybe the most tragic in Jewish history, but also maybe the most heroic. Wait till we see what was discovered in the 20th century, because even though they tried to wipe out Judaism, they were not successful. So the Rav affirms, in contrast to these wishy-washy relativistic approaches, that no, that our religion is superior. What does that mean, superior? Because we have a revelation. That doesn't mean that other people are damned or anything like that, but there is something called truth with a capital T. Again, an idea that is out of fashion today with relativism, with progressivism, with all these, the idea that you can insist that something's true. I mean, the whole notion of postmodernism is that it casts doubt on the very idea that you can affirm that something is actually true. I think that the Rav's approach here is the most productive in interfaith relations. And I even have an essay in which I respond to figures in the Orthodox community, Eugene Korn, Tamar Ross, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, even, who I think have gone too far in the direction of what I believe to be a relativism. I call it a soft relativism. And I think that it's perfectly acceptable to have respect for other religions if they make their adherence into better people, and not to try to missionize or anything, while still acknowledging that Judaism is the superior religion, in that it was, look, at the end of the day, it was the recipient of a revelation, and the others, although they could teach true doctrines and inspire their people, they are false in major claims. They're false about in the claim that Jesus is God and that the New Testament is a revelation, and they're false in the claim that the Quran is the authentic revelation and the Torah is false. I don't feel that adherents of other religions should be offended from a Jew asserting that. You can respect the other people. You can acknowledge that they're pious, but that doesn't mean that their religion is equal. So I think the Rav's position is indeed the position that should be advocated. He goes further. He says that by appraising the worth of your own religious experience as on the highest level, highest axiological level, he said that's the essence, he says, of religion. He says the feeling of axiological, he loved that word axiological, he used it a lot. The feeling of axiological equality of all faiths as a component of the individual religious experience is a contradiction in terms. A complete rejection of the idea that all religions are equal. Religious tolerance asserts itself in the knowledge of the existence of a variety and plurality of God experiences. So he says that that's what tolerance is, but it's never demanded that you have to give up the affirmation that your religion has more truth. At the end of the day, either Jesus is God or he's not God. And you can't, I teach in a Catholic University, and one of the essays I have the students write, I basically have stopped giving essays with ChatGPT, is because today it's almost impossible to find young people outside, I guess, of the Orthodox world who think there's a problem with interfaith marriage. But I ask them to write an essay on the pros and cons of interfaith marriage. And the typical view, well, these are Catholics, but still I think this would apply in general. The typical view is that it's very nice. You expose people to the different traditions. You expose them to the Christian traditions and the Jewish traditions. They grew up with appreciation for all these religions. Not one person's ever said the one positive about intermarriage is, I'm sure, it leads to less anti-Semitism, because if your brother-in-law is Jewish and all this, but so this is occasionally, when I'm a little brave, I'll ask the student who will explain in class that, you know, the beauty that you expose them to the different traditions. And I, from their perspective, you see it. You celebrate Passover and Easter and Hanukkah. So I say, but what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to go to church on Sunday or go to synagogue on Saturday? And if they say, well, you can do both, I say, well, what do you teach the children? I'm just trying to understand the logic of the argument. Do you teach the children that Jesus is God or you don't? You can't do both. Although it's, I don't think most people don't think theologically. The Rav concludes that paragraph saying it's forbidden to oppose our faith on others by force, but it's our sacred duty to defend our convictions. So this is included as part of a letter explaining that why we feel it's necessary, quite apart from the halachic reasons, that we're not going to back down, even though we're a minority. And even though we respect the other religions, we still need our share. After all, it's America, Jew, Christian, Jew, Catholic, Catholic, Protestant, Jew. Those were the three great in the 1950s, was it? Will Herbert's book, right? The three great religions. And we are entitled to some of these children for halachic reasons, the Rav feels, that based upon halacha, and we should be entitled to this. And the Rav goes further and he says that to yield to the demands of a certain non-Jewish group, I'm not sure who he's referring to, that all doubtful cases be placed in non-Jewish homes is tantamount not only to self-abasement as humans, but also to cardinal violations of the fundamentals of halacha and tradition. He says, we never tried to proselytize non-Jews, but we have never renounced our rights and laid legitimate claim to children whose identity is doubtful and the probability of their Jewish origin is not excluded. So the Rav wants the Jewish community, the American Jewish Congress, not an Orthodox organization, but he wants them to stand firm that these could be Jewish children, and therefore they should be given to Jewish adoption agencies. Now, part of the problem, which I would ask the Rav, is that they're not being given to Orthodox agencies. They're being given to Jewish agencies. So they could also give these kids to non-Orthodox people who are going to raise them either without conversion or they're going to raise them with a Reform conversion that's not valid. And then that creates a problem, doesn't it? Because then you have people, more people who think they're, at least in the 50s, you didn't have so much intermarriage. You'd have people thinking they're Jewish, involved in Jewish organizations, but not halachically Jewish. So I could see how someone would respond to the Rav that this is going to create more problems. It's one thing if you're going to tell me that all the children, all the babies you got would be given to Orthodox homes, but they're not being given to Orthodox homes. So I could see how, even from a pure halachic perspective, some people would argue with the Rav on this, but as I said, you have to look at the beginning of his letter to understand his halachic argument that even if we can't say that it's the majority, nevertheless, there are times we don't go by the majority and we assume there's a possibility and therefore it's our duty to take these children if we can proportionally and convert them. So fascinating, an issue which hasn't been relevant really in many, many years because you don't have, as I said, foundlings being distributed to different agencies. The next question is, it's a very long one in his letter. It's almost 40 pages. It might even be, because the previous letter that only deals a little with halacha, just a few, it's a few pages. But this is much more detailed. It might be the first real tshuva, halachic essay in English by an Orthodox figure. There were essays before, Jacob Lauterbach at the HUC. He was writing halachic responsa before this time. I can't recall off, and Louis Ginsberg wrote in English. I can't recall offhand. In fact, really, the previous letter, which I'm looking at it now again, which I just read to you, that's even earlier. That's 1950. And that's really a tshuva. It's shorter, but it deals with it's making a halachic argument based on sources. So I guess maybe that would be the first one. This is from 1951. Both of them, I would say, to my knowledge, are the first real halachic responsa written in English, halachic essays. Now, what's the question in the third letter here? It has to do with chaplains. You had Orthodox chaplains during World War II, no question about it. And but after the war, you then had the Korean, after World War II, things got back to normal, and then you have the Korean War, and you had chaplains again. The problem was that the Orthodox institutions, and we think of Orthodox institutions really in 1951, 50, you know, you're really thinking 52, 53, you're really thinking about just really yeshivas or Yitzhak Hachanan. I guess yeshivas Torah V'das, but Rabbi Yitzhak Hachanan, that's the real great seminary. And you have Chicago, Skokie, well, now Skokie, then Chicago. You didn't have many Orthodox going into the chaplaincy. Now, there was an organization called the Committee on Army and Naval Religious Activities, and they set a quota for 111 chaplains, and the way they determined it, that of the rabbis coming out of institutions, that the Orthodox should come up with 37 of that. But they weren't anywhere near the number. So Dr. Belkin wanted to know whether it would be halachically permissible for there to be a lottery that graduates of Yeshivas or Bitzel Chodin would have to put themselves into a draft, basically. They couldn't physically, but they could have sanctions on them. Just like the RCA had rules that you couldn't have private hashgachas, and if you did, they would sanction you. So, too, they would say that there'd be a lottery, and if you're chosen to go into the army for 2 years, let's say, and you refuse to, well, then they blackball you, and they wouldn't place you, and they put out the word that you're not a rabbi in good standing. So what's the problem? The problem is that Shabbos violations. And the issue isn't just the issue, and this is the reason why many of the Orthodox rabbis didn't enlist, because when you enlist, what's going to happen then if you get well, as the Rav explains it, there are two big problems where Shabbos violation, you're off in Korea or wherever you are, and you're told you have to go there on Shabbos, and also if you're a Kohen, what do you do about dead bodies? You might have to be with a soldier as he dies. You have to take care of burials and deal with cemeteries. And that's a problem for a Kohen. So the Orthodox, in large numbers, were avoiding this. And Dr. Belkin, it was a big Chil Hashem, you know, the Orthodox not getting involved. But it's only a Chil Hashem if it's permissible. If it's not permissible, you can't really say, you know, if we won't eat out in treif restaurants, we have a business center, we go to a non-kosher restaurant, but we don't eat anything, you can't say that's a chil hashem, because it's usher. But if it's not usher, then you can say it's a chil hashem. And that's what Dr. Belkin writes to the Rav, because although the RCA would be the one that would have to, like, sanction, nevertheless, the musmachim are coming out of Yeshivas for Bitzel Chanan. So you can make a rule that anyone who's going to get smicha here has to put their name in the hat, and you could be chosen to for the draft. So that's what the Rav, Dr. Belkin in 1951 writes to the Rav. And it's a very long letter. And the Rav begins the letter with, I've repeated this again and again, we've done this. I know Rabbi Kelman loves this page, and we've spoke about it many times, and I'll read it to you again. If you've come out of Orthodox yeshivas, maybe that's a, you know, no reason, it's a needless repetition. But if you spend time in the Orthodox world in yeshivas, there are people, not everyone, but I've certainly experienced this, who have tried to indoctrinate us that halacha is like a science. It's a computer. The information goes in and comes out, and there's no human element. And it was actually in response to this approach that Rav Lichtenstein has an essay called, I think it's called The Human Element or something in Halacha. But there are those who have this approach that Jewish law is, it doesn't have a subjective element to it. And it's all about the sources, what the sources said. Now, I always thought this was nonsense, because it's not an accident that a post-sake in the religious Zionist world is going to assume one thing when it comes to the state of Israel, and an anti-Zionist post-sake is going to assume something else. This doesn't mean that it's just Hefgeros, where there's rabbinic rule, there's rabbinic way, but the idea that there's objectivity. You try to be objective, but you also have certain values, and those values inform how you view the matter. If you're a more modern, open-minded type of post-sake, when you get a women's issue question, you're obviously going to have a different perspective on it. And I've said that, and often, you know, I'd be put knocked down that, you know, it's conservative Judaism, it's a higher Frank, all sorts of stuff, which I thought then was crazy. And I'm going to give you some good sources as well. But I remember when this letter came out, how happy I was to see what the Rav said. Because the Rav, before he even gets into the halachic argumentation, and it's very detailed and learned, and it goes back to issues already, the Baal Amor is an important source. I mean, there's all these issues. Can you put yourself in a situation where you know you're going to be forced to violate Shabbos, but right now you aren't? Right now what you're doing is 100% permissible, but it could happen in 2 days that you're going to be forced. So this is a question that Rishonim will deal with. Can you get on a boat, knowing that when you get to shore, they're going to force you to get off, and you can't get off on Shabbos, but now you're forced to. So it's an onus, you could say. So maybe you're allowed, but then when you should have not got on it maybe earlier, because you knew what was going to happen. These are questions the Rishonim dealt with. Before he gets into the halachic argumentation, the Rav says as follows, and listen carefully. He says, I've investigated this matter, which he says is fraught with grave political and social implications. We can all see what the political and social implications are. Can you imagine if the Orthodox community in the 1950s, when everything especially was then, it wasn't multiculturalism, it was all about, you know, fitting in, if the Orthodox community says that we cannot be chaplains, we cannot participate in America's wars, we cannot send our men of the cloth. There was in World War II, there was a great Kiddush Hashem when three clergymen, Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant, went down with the ship, and they even made a stamp about them, as I recall. And my father wrote about this in one of his books. It was, Jews were part of America. And there was a respect for them to say that we're going to be like the Amish, so we're withdrawing. That would have had enormous implications. Of course, if the halacha requires it, then it requires it. But you have to recognize the implications. So he says, I have to look at it very carefully. Then he says, quote, I cannot lay claim to objectivity if the latter, that is, if objectivity, should signify the absence of axiological premises and a completely emotionally detached attitude. We have his one of his favorite words, axiological, again. He says, if you're going to tell me that to be objective means that I don't have certain premises and that I'm emotionally detached from it, I cannot be that way. The halachic inquiry, like any other cognitive theoretical performance, does not start out from the point of absolute zero as to sentimental attitudes and value judgments. We all come with value judgments. If you think that this is a value for American Orthodox Jews to be in the chaplaincy, then you're going to evaluate the arguments very differently than if you believe that, you know, we should be living in some ghetto and not be part of wider society. There always exists in the mind of the researcher an ethico-axiological background against which the contours of the subject matter in question stand out more clearly. By the way, just as Derech Agav, as an aside, this is from 1951. The Rav has been in America less than 20 years. And look how he writes. I mean, he's writing, the language he uses is better than plenty of PhD students. I mean, it's unbelievable. So he says that in the back of the mind of the researcher, that is the posek, you have this ethical axiological background. In all fields of human intellectual endeavor, there is always an intuitive approach which determines the course and method of the analysis. Intuitively, you are led in a certain direction. Now, this doesn't mean, I write a lot about this with Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg in my book on him, because you see this very clearly with Rabbi Weinberg. This doesn't mean that just because intuitively you're moving in a direction that you'll always be able to find the answer that you want. But more often than not, you will, because that's the direction you're looking to. You're not coming at it objectively. You're coming with a goal, no different than when the rabbi comes to free the mamzer or the aguna. He has a goal. And this idea of intuition, intuitive feeling, we see, for instance, the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer has a passage in which, he doesn't have it, it's his son who mentions it, as I recall, it's an Igros Sofer, I forget, recording his son. The Chasam Sofer wrote a tshuva, and his son, the Ksav Sofer, read it and said, you know, the argument doesn't seem to, it's not so convincing. And the Chasam Sofer said, but it's correct. That is, intuitively, he knew it was correct. And he said, other people can produce better arguments. He said, what the Chasam Sofer was saying was that the truth or falsehood of my decision doesn't depend on the argument. You might say this is a mystical approach, even. He knew intuitively that it was correct. And the argument, you can get better arguments. But he thought, this is enough. Rav Asher Weiss has said that the Chazon Ish, when he came to deal with electricity, he knew it was usher. Intuitively, he knew it had to be usher. The only question was finding what was the usher. He knew it had to be usher. For whether Rav Asher Weiss means, because if you have electricity, even though at his time this wouldn't have been an issue, but once you permit it, in our days, can you imagine television, everything, the telephone? I understand that this is creates all sorts of problems, which you have to ask Rav Asher Weiss. Because how does this differ then from the argument that you make the bullseye and then you make the mark and then you draw the bullseye? How does this differ from, you know, the conservatives can say, well, we do the same thing. We just do it in a different direction. I don't know really how to formulate the differences, but I can tell you that there are plenty of sources that do speak about this idea that with great poskim, their intuition leads them, and the halachic arguments are not always the basis of the decision. So they join together with it, and with the Chasam Sofer, and according to Rav Asher Weiss, with the Chazon Ish, actually the intuition comes first. If you believe in Das Torah, I guess you can simply say that this is the Das Torah of the Gadol coming up with the halachic decision. But it's a fascinating thing that needs to be investigated. And then, so then the Rav says, therefore, this investigation was undertaken in a similar subjective mood. That is, he says, even in the exact sciences, there's a human element. He says, I'm subjective here. And that's just the way it is. He says, at the very outset, I was prejudiced in favor of the project of the Rabbinic Council of America. I could not imagine any halachic authority rendering a decision against it. My inquiry consisted only in translating a vague intuitive feeling into fixed terms of halachic discursive thinking. That what the Rav is saying, that intuitively, I knew this had to be mutter. I knew that there was no havamina to say that Orthodox Jews cannot be chaplains in the military with all the good that they would do. I just had to find out why it was permissible. That's what the Rav says. It's not me saying it. It's the Rav saying it. Now, again, it could it be that when the Rav would reach the end of his argument, he'd have to conclude that despite my intuition was a false intuition. I was so much enamored by this idea of being in the military, and it was so important to me that I assumed it had to be permissible. But in the end, my conclusion has to be no, that I was wrong. I was led astray by this intuition. That could be a result. If that was, then that would have been if the Rav's honest, and he would have had to say that if that was a result. But if you're already starting with this acknowledged intuitive feeling, you are going to read the sources in a certain way. And the Rav is honest. He acknowledges this, that he's not looking at it objective, and he doesn't see that this is a problem. Now, does this contradict the halachic man? The way he describes halachic man? We'll get back to this in a few minutes, because Gerald Blitzstein, Zichrono Libracha, who Rav Aaron Lichtenstein regarded as the greatest Talmud the Rav ever had. And Jerry Blitzstein countered that the Rav Lichtenstein was the greatest Talmud. But we'll see, it's Gerald Blitzstein, as I'll show you, he calls attention to the issue of halachic man, what seems to be the contradiction. So I'll explain what I mean when we finish the letter. And then the Rav says that he explains how he examines this issue first from a purely theoretical perspective, Lundus, I guess you could say, and then applying it in practice, because they're two different realms. The Rav is generally a Talmudist, not engaging in traditional Shevot and Shuvot. Even though he would issue Psakim, he didn't really engage in traditional Shuvot as a general rule. He was more of a Rosh Yeshiva. And in Halachic Man, he valorizes this idea of pure Talmudic study without practical halachic implications. But sometimes he's called upon into the trenches, as it were, and he has to leave the confines of the Beis Medrash, and his rulings have to apply practically. I think too much is probably made about this. If you're in New York, the idea is that the Rav's the Rosh Hashiva and Rav Moshe's the Posek. That's why they said it's ironic that Rav Moshe was called... that the Rav is called the Rav and Rav Moshe is the Rosh Yeshiva, when Rav Moshe, most people know him as the Posek, the Rav, and Rav Soloveitchik as the Rosh Yeshiva. But of course, in Boston, he was also deciding halacha. Every single day, he's deciding halacha. But that wasn't, if you read Halachic Man, at least, you see that this is not where his heart was. His heart was into pure lundus. And he describes the practical halachic decision making, asuki shmatza lid behochasa, sort of like the difference between a professor of law versus a lawyer, or a professor of medicine versus a practical, doctor. You have to make a parnasa, so you have to do this. But really, you'd like to just be focusing on the research. That the exact opposite of like Rav Avad Yosef. If you look in the introduction to his Yabi Omer, he says on the contrary, practical halachic decision making is the highest level. But from the Brisker, from the Lithuanian approach, no. The theoretical halacha is the highest. So then we have many, many pages in which the Rav goes through all the different halachic issues here, trying to make the case that this would be permissible. And he says, right towards the end of it, he says that he deals with, he wants to argue on onus. That once you're forced, once you become a chaplain, which is permissible, then if it happens later that you're forced to, let's say, violate Shabbos, he doesn't deal with coping, even though that was let's see, he mentions or maybe Dr. Belkin mentions it. I can't remember now where I saw. It's here somewhere about the choline. I'll get to it. Because he must have mentioned it, the Rav, not Belkin. He wants to develop the argument of onus, that when you enlist, it's permissible, and then later you're forced to, it's an onus. So what's the onus? We know that Shabbos is such a big deal. If it's pikuach nefesh, you can violate it, but you can't just violate it because they reduce your rank or anything like that. So what's the onus? And I have to say that it's a, I think at least in one of his arguments, he's going out on a limb a little bit, because he does say, we all know that there's sakonos pikuach nefesh. However, he himself says, if the Orthodox chaplain refuses to obey orders, are you going to be put, fine, you'll be put in jail. But, you know, where's the threat to life? And, he argues in a few ways. First, he says that, if the Orthodox chaplain should refuse to obey orders in the army, it might affect the political status of the Jew in this country and prove disastrous. This alone is a legitimate reason for subsuming the coercive situation under the class of pikuach nefesh. We know that Jews have violated Shabbos, let's say, for treating non-Jews medically on Shabbos, even though if you just look in the Gemara, technically you can say you're not allowed to violate Shabbos. But to be part of a society where Jews are treated equally, and we all know where this can lead to. Incidentally, the Rav was not very happy with this argument. Jerry Blitzin asked him, are you ethically satisfied with this argument that you treat non-Jews on Shabbos? Because if you don't treat them, they won't treat us. He says it doesn't satisfy him ethically. Yeah. We know that even matters which might eventually lead to problems that affect Jewish statuses, that could even have pikuach nefesh implications. You know, non-Jew could riot in Peoria if he hears about something crazy that he thinks going on in New York. All these things the poskim have considered in the past. And the Rav thinks that the specter of Orthodox Jews saying that we don't want to be a part of this army, we don't consider this valuable enough, he thinks that that alone would that if you're forced in an onus, that that could put you in the case of pikuach nefesh. He also argues, he says, second of all, he says that he says there's another type of onus. He discusses three types of onus, and he says the third type of onus that he thinks this could fall into. Hold on, I'll tell you what he says here. There's different types of being forced, and where is it here? Here he says there are times when he says that a soldier inculcated with the spirit of absolute blind obedience, the individual completely loses his freedom of will and his faculty of rational thinking. So his action is more the result of an instinctive response to an order rather than a deliberate choice. This is where I think is weak, but the Rav argues that when you're in the army, anyone, he's including a chaplain in the army, the idea of following orders is so ingrained in you that it really puts it in an onus, and it's unimaginable that you don't follow orders. So therefore, the action might technically not be permissible, but he cites other examples where people, mentally, they're in such a place that after the fact, we regard this as they're not chayav for violating Shabbos because of the situation they were in. I have to say, I find this a stretch, because we're dealing with a chaplain who is trained to think about these matters, and I don't think that this type of onus, the way he compares it to people whose minds are simply they're not really thinking with free will, they're just thinking in terms of obedience. I find it difficult, but we still have the other example he gave, and then he says this: when you deal with a chaplain, there's no certainty. There's a possibility. So you can certainly enlist in the army. And then if it happens, you can rely, he says, on the coercive situation because you didn't know it was going to come intentionally. We may therefore say that enlisting in the chaplain in the armed forces is permissible according to halacha. So the Rav, again, I have to say, I find the argument, the onus argument, extremely weak, if I can say so, bending over backwards. But I think the point is that the Rav knows he's bending over backwards. He says that. He says that this result is something that's important. And the other argument of how this will make Orthodox Jews look, they won't be regarded as real Americans. And therefore, if you're put in a situation, you can violate Shabbos. I mean, I know that each one of his arguments individually, you can attack and maybe try to undermine. When you put them all together, you'll have to judge yourself whether you think it makes a compelling case. I think, therefore, we have to say that the Rav is telling us that it might not be the most compelling case, but that's where the intuitive feeling comes in. And the idea that Orthodox Jews could not be chaplains. So he's giving these arguments, which I love to see how other poskim would look at these arguments. So he says, he concludes that you can be a chaplain. But then he says, fine, I've showed that you can, but does the halacha recommend it? He says, halacha, does it only permit it? Or does it also approve and recommend? And then he explains that absolutely the halacha recommends it. So it's not just something that someone can do it if he wishes, rather it's something that should be done. And therefore the yeshiva can, RCA can require this. And he explains that it would be a disaster. Are we going to let the chaplaincy just be the non-Orthodox rabbis? I mean, you're going to have reform and conservative rabbis controlling the military. That's what Judaism is for all these people. He says that we can never allow that. And he elaborates on that. He concludes by saying that what I've just told you is not just a pragmatic utilitarian approach. He says that this is the halachic historic tradition, which wants to see the Jew committed to all social and national institutions of the land of his birth. The halacha wants the Jew to be afforded all the privileges and prerogatives of citizenship. A Satmar Posek can never say this. A Satmar Posek is living in Williamsburg or Kiryas Yoha or something. They don't want to be part of larger American society. On the contrary, they want to escape it. They want to create these walls. The Rav wants us to be part. That's the biggest Kiddush Hashem, that Jews are part of American society, helping to create the society, being part of it. And he tells us that the halacha wants to see the Jew committed to all social and national institutions. That's our job. And you can't do this job if you're not partaking in one of the, especially in the 1950s, you know, the military, which was such an important element. He says, listen to this. The halacha emphasizes the duty of the Jew to share in the defense of his homeland in the way which he is best fitted. Since we as rabbis cannot participate in the physical defense effort, the only way in which we are able to serve our country is to offer counsel and spiritual comfort to those who are called upon to perform this great physical task. Let us remember that the burden they carry is by far a heavier one than ours. This is the Rav as the patriot speaking. We're rabbis, so we're not soldiers. I mean, in Eretz Yisrael, I guess he'll see that he would learn that you can be a rabbi and a soldier. But he's saying we're not soldiers, but we still have to do our duty. The young Jews in America are part of the army. They're risking their lives. We need to be there providing Torah messages to them. And many of these are Orthodox Jews. And we need to be there to serve them. And then he goes on a few more pages. But I think it's... I think it's an amazing letter, as I said, for the acknowledged subjectivity. I think the conclusion, I think the patriotism, I think the vision of the Jews' role in American society. Remember, this is a very patriotic 1950s up against the specter of communism and the role of the Jew trying finally accepted in America, trying to fit in. All these play a role, and the Rav tells us that all these play a role. The halacha arguments, it's a stretch, I think. Am I disrespectful for saying that? I ask, we have people of greater halachic authorities than myself listening to us. Read the Rav's letter. Let me know. Do you agree with me that it's a stretch, especially the onus, the third onus that the Rav describes, that when you're in the army or in such a situation that it's second nature, you always need to follow orders. So therefore, because is that the reality? Maybe it is the reality. Maybe, and you know, I don't see here. Maybe it was in Blitzstein's article, which we'll get to next class. He raises the problem of Kohen. It's not raised in the Rav's essay here. He just focuses on Shabbos. But I think that the Kohen issue would be a similar question. Actually, Shabbos is more important. You know, Shabbos is of a higher level. So if you can permit a chaplain who might violate Shabbos, you can certainly permit him if he might be metame, especially it could be mace mitzvah and all these things. But this is, it's a very, and this is what set the policy. As a result of this, they instituted such a policy of requiring putting yourself in as part of the chaplaincy. Next class, I wanted to share with you what the Aruch HaShulchan says, where the Aruch HaShulchan also speaks about a subjectivity, similar to the Rav. So maybe this is a Lithuanian tradition, and I'll tell you what Rav Yitzhak Yosef said, that whether you might conclude that he agrees with the Rav or disagrees with the Rav, and Jared Blitzstein, because Jared Blitzstein has an essay in which he discusses these letters of the Rav, and he focuses in particular on this letter, and I think you'll find insightful what Jared Blitzstein has to say. So with this, let me take some of the comments and questions. Let me pull it up here. The newspaper of the Kana Howard Beach article was from is, and you say, so we believe everything in print anywhere? The article is from the Jewish Post and Opinion at the time when Meir Kahana was fired. It was a big deal. It made national news. Moshe sent me articles from other papers. So they went and they interviewed the president of the shul, and the president of the shul, when describing all the terrible things that Kahana did, said, and this is all these terrible things he did, this is after we agreed to put up a machitza. So here you have a contemporaneous source. Forget Libby Kahana. The contemporaneous source is telling you that they agreed. So therefore, if you have to Rabbi Rakefet's version versus Libby Kahana's version, I have to assume that Rabbi Rakefet's are repeating a story he heard. And remember, written evidence counts for more than stories. So we can discount Libby Kahana because we said that maybe she's the wife and all that. But here we have black on white from the Times. So there's no question that of what the truth is. Rabbi Kelman says, on the topic of all religions being true, there's a talk given by Rameir Soloveitcher some 15 years ago in the early days of Torah Motion. Yes. Those were the days when Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik was a little rabbi with some interesting ideas. He would publish occasionally a provocative article and commentary. Now I have to tell you that he is the leading Orthodox public intellectual, and I believe he is the leading rabbi public intellectual in the world. I mean, if you know what Meir Soloveitchik is doing, forget Jerusalem 365, how he comes up every day with a thing on Jerusalem. They did his Bible 365, but his involvement in so many areas dealing with Americanism and think tanks, not to mention running the Strauss Center at Yeshiva University, he just came out with his first book. He's really amazing. And Rabbi Kelman, before Meir Soloveitchik was Meir Soloveitchik, that we know now, had him up, and I was there once with him at Torah in Motion. And some good talks there. And I had him at University of Scranton twice. And once it's not recorded, I couldn't afford him anymore. I know that. And he doesn't have time for my little university. But so he would have given a traditional perspective, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, on this. But it's I have an essay on this because Yitz Greenberg also, for some reason, there's Orthodox Jews that feel that you need to move in the direction of relativism. And I don't see why you need to do that. Why you can be respectful of other faith traditions and still say that their truth claims are false. That is, they're factual truth claims. What they claim to be factual are false. But you can still respect the fact that their religion, even though the theology is not factually correct, still is valuable and helps them lead a good life. The Rambam himself acknowledges that there's value to Christianity and Islam. As far as Christianity, he thought Christianity is a avodah zarah, but he still is willing to acknowledge that. Rav Kook is more complicated, as you'll see in my new book, God Willing, because Rav Kook has some very provocative things to say about the role of other religions that goes beyond the Rambam. But still, I think the Rav's position, as far as I'm concerned, makes the most sense. Rabbi Yellen is quoting Louis Jacobs saying, "I would go so far as to say that in considering responsa literature on many instances of pressing social concern, one can guess more or less accurately from the background of the halachist whose guidance is being sought what his ruling will be." All I think I would add to that is not always, because every real posek is going to have times where they surprise you, because that's what makes them authentic. However, there's a reason why certain poskim are known as mekilim and others are known as machmirim, because we're going to see in the next class, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, when he tells you that when you approach the matter, begin with the assumption that it's mutter. Well, odds are you're going to assume it's mutter, because if you begin with the assumption it's mutter, and then you have to see if there's something that says it's usser, your decision is going to be lakua more than if you start that it's usser and then try to find that it's mutter. And although Rabbi Louis Jacobs was not in the Orthodox world, his book on halacha is very insightful, and I think it's in line with what all the scholars, the academic scholars, Yaakov Katz and Chaim Soloveitchik and Ephraim Orbach, really the way they describe the halachic system as well. What's not traditional is the end of the book, where he wants to develop a non-fundamentalist, as he calls it, approach to halacha. Rabbi Shudnow, one of our chaplains, says the term enlisting is not employed for commissioned officers such as chaplains. Yes. When I forgot what I read there, if the Rav was maybe using it incorrectly, or if he was only speaking there about the soldiers, or I used it incorrectly. And the JW Commission on Jewish Chaplaincy made its own decisions applying to all Jewish chaplains then. And Rabbi Shudnow, send me a letter privately, and I'll send you what you want. Someone privately asked, did I know that Rabbi Rachman graduated from the Harvard Chaplaincy School in 1944? I didn't know that he graduated from that. I knew that he, at least I think I knew, that he was a chaplain. We had many Orthodox chaplains. Louis Bernstein, during this time in the 50s, he was, I don't know if he volunteered or if he was chosen or whatever it was, he was in Germany. You had a number of Orthodox chaplains. If we can, before we end, Rabbi Yellen, since you were a chaplain as well, and also Rabbi Shudnow, you can add also, were these issues you ever thought, I don't know if you were Vietnam era or something, but were these issues that you ever thought about or considered?
Well, and I am a Cohen. Yes, interestingly enough, this was right after Vietnam, and I did ask Shaila, and I was told it was okay. I didn't quite go into the depth that you did, but I was told it was okay. And by the way, when I was a chaplain, which was in 76 and 77, by far the majority of the Jewish chaplains were Orthodox. Not even a plurality, a majority at that time were Orthodox.
They weren't Chabad in those days, were they? Like today,
no Chabad. Now Chabad has its own certifying agency. At that time was only the Jewish Welfare Board. Everyone went through that. And as I said, the majority were Orthodox. Today, Chabad, through the Aleph Institute, has its own certifying agency. And I think actually they're now, not that most of the chaplains are Chabad, but most of the chaplains, Chabad or not, go through the Aleph Jewish Chaplaincy certifying agency.
You know,
things have changed a great deal. When we say that then, in the 70s, that most chaplains were Orthodox, that's true of the Army. And the Army did have a special connection, and especially through YU. That was not so much the case with the Navy at all. And during my time, I was even told that I should consider going into the Army and not the Navy because of my religious observances.
That's interesting. Okay, just I can to tell end you this, that,
when I was a chaplain, there were 30 3 full-time Jewish chaplains in the entire military. Remember, this is after Vietnam. So we're talking about all the services with 33 full-time, there are many more part-time. And the majority of those at that time in all the services together were Orthodox. Now, the Army had the vast majority of the chaplains, so therefore that may have skewed it. But the total in the military...
Well, I was present when Abraham Joshua Heschel had spoken out to JTS. And at the time of Vietnam, he was very, very much against our participation in Vietnam. And the rabbinical assembly dropped the requirement for military chaplaincy at that time. So it's exactly the time you're speaking of.
And it's interesting because we saw that by Korea, they wanted that in the 50s, they wanted 111 chaplains. So it's many more. What's the law for some reason doesn't mention something that I find surprising, that in terms of Chil Shabbos, at most, I think it would be rabbinic. You know, if you're told as a chaplain, you have to go there, you're not, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you're getting in the car and driving if someone's driving you, right? You're getting on an airplane. So almost uniformly, it would be rabbinic prohibitions that would not be problematic to waive them. I don't know why he doesn't mention that. And finally, I see Nissan, and when this will be the last comment. I thank both Rabbi Shudden and Rabbi Yellen for, as always, but especially now from your own personal experiences in the Navy, the rabbi in Austin, the Orthodox rabbi in Austin, Texas, is in the Naval Reserve. Nissan says that the Rambam phrase, the ecumenical ideas I expressed, that was censored and only presented in its entirety by the Ramban and Torah Hashem Tamima. But today, if you open up any good edition of the Mishnah Torah, go to the end, the last halacha in Hilchos Malachim, and you will find where he says, he asked the question, why? What's the purpose of Islam and Christianity? And he explains they do have a purpose, and they're part of the messianic plan to bring people to recognition of the divine and of revelation.
My point was only that the church didn't consider it to be other than pejorative.
Well, yes, because his views are not, he's putting him second rate, and the Rambam's views about Christianity is extremely negative. And nevertheless, it still was an improvement, he says, to what came before. And okay, I want to thank you all. It was another good semester, and I wish all of you, I'll see some of you this summer, and the rest of you have an enjoyable and safe and wonderful summer full of simchas. And I look forward to after the nice vacation and you have, and my working vacation, we see each other again. Continue with the Rav, but we're not going on 2 years with the Rav. Maybe another 5 or 6 classes, and then move on to other topics. And I know Rabbi Yellen asked me about the Mussar movement. I'm all ready. I could start tomorrow. I could start the Mussar dispute. It's all ready. But as Rabbi Rakefet likes to say, we have to have sovlanitis. Or he says, people, when they say you have sovlanitis, that is, we have to be patient. We'll get there. And I thank Rabbi Kelman for giving me these opportunities to just basically open-ended. He never said to me, let's do 4 classes on this, 6 classes. His attitude is like, however long it takes, it's like the Rav. The Rav would come into Shir, and there was never a time. He would end when he's done. And there's a famous story, Thanksgiving, because he gave Shir Thanksgiving. But he'd have to go back. So, I mean, they're getting nervous, because normally Shir like 2 hours, going 3 hours, 3.5 hours. But he says, until we finish the Tosfos, no one's leaving. So there never was a set time. So we have a set time because we have to finish in terms of the hour, but in terms of how long we spend, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. So you could take it away.
Our pleasure. We don't have an exactly set time. It is 9:45, and the official time, of course, is 9:30. So that's fine. Even on the set time, it's fine. I thank you very much for that. Yes, and we'll keep going. Is how long it's when we finish? There's no finish. Torah is ongoing. Okay. Yes. Okay. Have a wonderful trip. Please God, we'll see you next week across the Atlantic. And we have people coming on trips looking forward, and we look forward to everybody here having you back in 7-8 weeks back here on our Monday night schedule. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman's class is starting a half an hour later than usual. Instead of 1 o'clock, he's actually in Israel. And he's starting class 1:30. I think following weeks it will be at 1, but tomorrow will be at 1:30, 8:30 Israeli time. And then please God, tomorrow we'll send out the sort of our summer schedule, our new classes that we are starting. I can tell you next Monday, Rabbi Yitzchak Et Shalom will be starting a 5-part series on Megillat Eicha, among other things. We'll be starting in a few classes here and there. So keep on the lookout for that. And okay, everybody, have a wonderful week, and we will. We should hear good things. And okay, Laila Tov, everybody. And David,
Laila Tov
in Beit Shemesh. Okay, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.